Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. And on Mondays, we always spend some time talking about the international economy, the national economy, state economy, local economy. And today will be no different. A lot going on. Guy, welcome to the show.
Paul, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So a whole bunch of trade deals have been reached here recently. Deals with Japan, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, Britain, and one announced today with EU. We have paused rate deals right now with both India and China. Those deals still being worked on. A lot of folks were very critical of the progress early on said here. These are very complex matters, but a lot of these things seem to be falling into place. Your thoughts?
They are, and I think it's a real pleasant surprise and good for the U.S. economy that we've worked out deals with the EU and Japan. Those are our biggest trading partners, except for Mexico and Canada. So if we can get to deals with the EU, which it looks like we have, and that was announced this morning, as well as Japan, and then move on to Mexico and Canada, it really would put the tariff situation sort of on the back burner. And that's been a big concern for the Fed. It's been a big concern for manufacturers. And most importantly, it is essentially impossible to plan on building a plant until you know for sure what the tariff rules are. So once that's locked into place, then people can start making plans. So this is pretty encouraging news. You still have some worrying things like the 50% tariff on steel and aluminum, but getting to the 15% deal with the EU and the 10% deal with the UK is really good news for the U.S. economy.
Guy, early on said, I know you won't say it, but I'll say it, you thought that this is where this would end up, somewhere between, you know, 10 to 15, you know, in that area. Feeling like some of the manufacturers, some of the countries would be able to absorb these tariffs and you wouldn't see big implications to consumers.
Yeah, I did, and I was relying on some economic papers from the 40s. There's a theory of optimum tariffs that suggests that if you're the major player, there's an optimum level somewhere between 10, not higher than 20, where you actually end up somewhat better off, and the exporters pick up most of the tab. So I was hoping that maybe the U.S. tariff negotiators were relying on economic theories rather than emotion, and that it would end up in this range. And so far, it looks like the exporters are picking up a fair amount of that. Importers are picking up some, and of course, some will pass on to consumers. So it's not inconsequential, but it's not going to be an immediate 15% increase on the consumer side. You'll probably see less than half of that actually passed on to the consumer.
It seems as though this really kind of flips the script, right, of a global economy and how this is going to work from the U.S. perspective.
Well, it does, but it also sets up some certainty and finality to it. And that really is vitally important. And I think the fact that you now know and can plan on what the tariffs are makes a tremendous difference. So if you're building a plan, if you're thinking about reshoring, you now know at least what your prices are going to be. So that makes a difference. And I think it also will, it'll be good for the U.S. to put this behind it and be able to focus on other issues. So to the extent we can wrap the tariffs up in the next 30 or 90 days, that would be a wonderful thing, because then you move on to solving the immigration and deficit issues. And those are the two big challenges that remain to be dealt with.
Interestingly, a lot of side conversations with these leaders of these countries on both energy and immigration as well.
Yeah, and we're getting some encouragement, particularly in the EU. They're looking at buying more U.S. energy, which makes tremendous sense. I mean, they realize that relying on Russia is incredibly dangerous. I mean, Russia is a predatory country. Their objective is to expand their empire. And, you know, it's taken three bitter years of war for the Europeans and the U.S. to realize Russia's intentions are just genuinely evil. So Europeans are saying we need to have a better source of energy. You can't replace natural gas with solar and windmills in the short run until you solve the storage problem. So the Europeans are committing to buying U.S. energy, and that helps us right here in Louisiana. I mean, we are building those plants that compress and export natural gas. So this is where foreign policy really affects us in the state of Louisiana. If you try and drive to Belchase, you'll have a hard time with the traffic because of the construction that's going on down into Plaquemines.
Guy, a lot of folks are saying that we're already seeing the price increases as it relates to these tariffs. And maybe there is some that has revealed itself, but is that necessarily true?
Well, there will be some price increases. There's no doubt about that. But we're not seeing the price increases that match the tariffs. And that's the point of the efficient tariff theory, is that you'll be able to get more revenue and the cost will be disproportionately paid by the exporter. And, I mean, at this moment, it looks like that may be true. Now, certainly there will be price increases, and there are certain items that are unique and not replaceable easily. And in those cases, the manufacturer just saying, no, we're charging the same price. And, I mean, it's an extreme and silly example, but you look at things like, you know, Maserati and Ferrari automobiles, you know, you can't replace that easily. There's no domestic competitor, so if you want that vehicle, the price is just going to go up. But there aren't many things that are irreplaceable. There are some, though, that we really do need, and one is the avocado. Most of those are made in Mexico and grown there. If we really end up with the high tariffs in Mexico, we're going to see avocado prices go up. So some will pass on, not all of it, and so far it's slightly inflationary, but not to the extent of the full tariff.
But when you talk about, and we're going to talk about the U.S. government and, you know, the U.S. car industry in a moment, but it would seem to me that if you have increased pricing on these foreign car, on these imported foreign cars, because a number of them are now made in the U.S., so I don't guess they don't face the tariff, that's got to help the U.S. auto industry, right? You're not going to find a perfect match to a lot of these foreign imports that are brought in, but there are cars that are similar, but not necessarily the same, that are another option. If you're price sensitive,
I think the big area where you're going to run into challenges is that we don't really make sedans in the U.S. anymore. So if you want what we used to traditionally call a car, you really need to get that from Europe, Japan, or South Korea. And, of course, we've totally blocked the Japanese electric vehicles, which are pretty revolutionary. So there should be some help for U.S. manufacturers, but, you know, that's a whole different challenge.
The cars that are made by Japanese companies in the U.S., are they facing tariffs? No, right?
No. If you're making the car in the U.S., you know, it's not an import. You know, obviously you're paying local taxes, you're hiring local workers, and you're building the car in the United States. And that was the purpose of a lot of the U.S. pushing people to make cars in the United States. Because, yeah. I mean, right now you have, you know, Ford makes about 18% of the U.S. cars, you know, GM 16, Chrysler 11, but Toyota and Honda right behind with 11 and 10. So U.S. production is beginning to shift toward foreign manufacturers, certainly not not the overwhelming number of U.S. manufacturers that we used to have.
Yeah. All right, let's get to a break. When we come back, we'll talk about how the government protected and regulated the U.S. car industry into global irrelevance. When we return, we're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, let's talk about how the U.S. government protected and regulated the car industry here into what you say is global irrelevance. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's a good reminder to anybody in business. Anytime the U.S. government shows up and says they want to protect you from competition, you should tell them thanks, but no thanks. Go away. Please don't. We want to compete globally. We don't want you protecting us at all. And, I mean, a silly example is if Saints aren't expected to have a great season, but if the Saints said, you know, we really want to protect the players, so we're going to scrimmage against high school football players. Now, that would seem great. You know, you're not going to get hurt. You're going to have people you can push around. But then when you play in the real NFL in the fall, you're going to get crushed. Well, going way back, it's always been a priority of administrations to protect the auto industry. U.S. makers used to produce 80% of the global car market, absolutely dominated the global car market in the 50s. And as the Japanese started to finally compete and to create competitive small cars, the automaker said, you know, we really need some protection. And this is something that both political parties fall for. Ronald Reagan fell for this protectionist claim and said, well, we're going to put some tariffs. We're going to have some import restrictions. We're going to have some quotas so that the American auto manufacturers will be protected from this unfair competition. Well, if we look back, General Motors at their peak had 618,000 employees. They have 77,000 today. Ford, 256,000. They have 56,000 today. Chrysler, which is now Stellantis, 152,000, now down to 39,000. So starting with Reagan, coming forward, successive administrations put up different barriers. The idea was always, we're going to protect the U.S. auto industry. Well, the financial crisis, 2008, the U.S. automakers went broke and had to be bailed out by the U.S. government. But employment continued to decline. And now, on a global scale, we're almost irrelevant. And in the middle of that, the U.S. did a lot of other things that had good purposes but achieved perverse outcomes. And economists hate those things where you're trying to achieve A, you put in a policy, and you actually make it worse. And the best example is the corporate average fuel economy. U.S. decided we're going to start having very high fuel economy standards, and the latest ones in Democratic administrations were pushing toward 50 miles per gallon. And every time you would have a fuel economy standard, the announcement would be, this is going to save consumers a ton of money. It's going to save so much each year. But if you think about it, there's not a gas-powered car that gets 50 miles to the gallon. So what happened is we used to make sedans in this car. We were talking about that earlier. You know, going back to 1960, 84% of the cars were sedans. They were just, you know, four-door cars. You remember that growing up. Your parents probably had one. You drove around in it. Trucks were 15%. Trucks were exempt from the corporate average fuel economy. Now, sedans are 17% of the U.S. market. Trucks are 83%. And trucks are counting SUVs. Well, what happened is the U.S. manufacturers did what they logically should do. It's like, okay, we can't meet these fuel economy standards, so we're going to produce something that's exempt. The administrations knew that they couldn't meet the standards, so they said, all right, yep, go ahead and make the trucks. So we flip-flopped, and now we make gas-guzzling trucks. And if you're on the environmental side, you say, wait a minute. This actually made the environment worse. We're consuming more gas per vehicle because everybody's buying big trucks and big SUVs. And it was interesting, as I was driving to work, I was trying to just look on the road and see if I could find a four-door car made in America. And I didn't see any. I didn't see a single U.S. four-door sedan, except finally when I got right downtown, I saw an old Crown Victoria, which hadn't been made for a while. So with the objective of protection, we shielded the car makers from competing with the more efficient Japanese. Then with the objective of saving fuel, we created corporate average fuel economy standards that pushed us to making big trucks. But these big trucks aren't exportable to the rest of the world. With rare exceptions, they're not really desired in Europe or anywhere else in the world. So we pushed our makers into making something to comply with the federal regulation that they can't sell overseas. And the inevitable occurred. You ended up with significantly less workers working for U.S. auto manufacturers. So you've had a tremendous decline. And we haven't even talked about the EV push and then the EV relaxation, which is causing a further challenge for the industry.
Yeah, I mean, the employment numbers, I knew they were bad. I knew they lost a lot. I had no idea it was that much. I mean, that shocked
me. It's horrendous. There's a car guy named Brock Yates that wrote for Car and Driver wrote a book called The Decline and Fall of the U.S. Auto Industry. And it really is an intriguing read. It was written a few years ago, but I would recommend it. You know, the EV challenge is also a problem. U.S. manufacturers put tremendous resources into building EVs. And while they're great cars, and Tesla obviously pioneered that technology, sales got close to 10%, and now they're 9% and declining. So General Motors, which said, we're going to make all EVs by 2035, is having to reverse course and say, well, you know, the consumer doesn't seem to want EVs. So we're going to have to think of something different. And this was something that the government pushed people into. You can only spend your research money so many times. And in this case, the car makers were pushed into unrealistic acceleration of EV manufacturing, which pushed them even further behind. And so now you've wasted a lot of money on cars people don't want to buy. You're having to retool to make things that people do want to buy. And the scary thing is, it's pushing auto sales down. Actually, Q2 auto sales were down 8% in the United States.
Well, you also had the incentives that were being offered. As they go away, you can't sell these cars. And then under the Inflation Reduction Act, all of the charging stations that were supposed to be built, I mean, I don't think they were able to build 10% of the ones that they proposed to build. And there's really no path forward to even do this in an effective and efficient way. So there's no infrastructure. And without the federal dollars there, a lot of people are not going to go and expend these dollars now, right, for infrastructure. So these auto manufacturers are left with an albatross vehicle that they can't get rid of.
Yeah, and now we've pushed automakers into a very difficult situation. So their R&D money went into vehicles that people don't want. You know, under the prior administration, there was approval of significant money to build charging stations, but it just never got done. And the approval was really, it was messed up with a lot of social issues. One was, we want to put charging stations in every neighborhood, not just rich neighborhoods. And that seems like a great idea, except you were putting charging stations in neighborhoods that statistically had no electric vehicles. So what few charging stations were built weren't put where people needed them and wanted them, and very, very few were constructed. And now we have, as I say, it seems to be stabilizing around 9%. And that's not enough to justify a massive expansion in charging stations. and I know lots of people are mad at Elon Musk, but his supercharger network really worked. I mean, he pioneered that and created a network that is usable. It's challenging. You still have to locate them, but at least he did build that network, and he built that essentially without government subsidy.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting where this all goes. 384 charging ports were built thus far at 68 stations in 16 states. You know, they had billions and billions and billions of dollars appropriated for that purpose, and they weren't able to deliver.
Yeah, there was an interesting sidelight on the charging stations, which is because of the delays, a lot of people were resistant. And then Buc-ee's started putting in charging stations at Buc-ee's, and suddenly it's like, oh, that's not all bad. I can stop at Buc-ee's and get some barbecue.
Yeah. Well, if anybody's going to do it and succeed, it'll be Buc-ee's. That's for sure. I mean, that place is unbelievable. Have you been to the new one?
Yeah, well, I was at the one just across the state line in Mississippi.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I was impressed. It's quite an operation, and the barbecue actually is surprisingly good.
It is good. I certainly enjoyed it for sure. All right, let's pivot. Let's talk about stable coin. All these coins, I am so in the weeds and in the fog about what these things are, why you want them, why you don't want one. So what is a stable coin?
Yeah, let's start with definition. A lot of people think about Bitcoin and Ether, and we'll talk about that later, but stablecoin is designed to maintain a value of $1. So instead of Bitcoin, which can go up and down, or Ether that or Ethereum or one of the others that can go up and down, a stablecoin is designed to maintain its value of $1. Now, you might think to yourself, okay, why would I want that? Because if I have a dollar in my pocket, I have a dollar, and it will remain a dollar. It's going to continue. It's not going to change. It's not going to be magically $2 or 50 cents. And the U.S. passed a law called the Genius Act that regulates stablecoins. And it's an interesting act, and it's one of those things. The administration wants to be the crypto center of the universe. And the Genius Act is called the Generating Establishing National Innovation for U.S. And it did a number of things. It defined a stablecoin, and the simple definition is what I just said, something that maintains a value of a dollar. And it listed who can issue stablecoins, you know, primarily banks, primarily well-funded brokerages. But one of the things that it did is it prohibited paying interest on stable coins. And so it also requires, and we'll come back to interest, you have to comply with the Bank Secrecy Act and the anti-money laundering laws. It did say that a stable coin is not a commodity, nor is it a security. And that was important because there's a lot of confusion about both. But if you think about it, so you have money. You have money in a bank, you have it in a savings account, a money market account, and you buy a stable coin. Well, it is now guaranteed to stay at $1. But if you think about it, when that money was in your savings account, your money market account, you were actually earning interest. The Genius Act prohibits paying interest on stable coin. So you are guaranteed to not make any money. Now, you're guaranteed it'll stay at a dollar, but physical dollar bills would do the same. Money in a bank account that pays interest will not go below a dollar, and it will gain interest. Your stable coin is guaranteed to be a non-earning asset. It's the equivalent of taking your savings and burying it in a hole in the ground. So tremendous interest in stable coins, and you might wonder why. I mean, why do you want something that's the functional equivalent of burying your net worth in a hole in the ground? And the answer that people give is, well, I can use it for instantaneous transfers. And, you know, our answer to that would be, well, you pretty much can do that already. You can either use a credit card, debit card, you know, one of the channels like PayPal. But the idea of a stable coin is that companies will want to transfer around the clock, and they'll use stable coins because they can do it instantaneously. And so there is this new rule, this new law, but from an investor standpoint, there's really no reason to buy a stable coin. I mean, you're guaranteeing that you will not make any money. It reminds me of when you go to Las Vegas and they have these signs about our slot machines pay out 98.5. It's like, well, wait, that's less than a dollar. Why would I do that? Stablecoin guarantees you will not make any interest. And it's interesting to me, but there's so much intriguing interest in buying stablecoins, but you're guaranteed not to make any money. So unless you have a need to make transactions 24 hours a day, I really don't see a reason to buy a stablecoin.
Yeah, none of that makes any sense. I mean, what's the attractiveness? I mean, you mentioned one positive, but I mean, you know, that doesn't seem like that would be the seller to forego any interest that you could earn on that dollar.
Yeah, the original thought I think people had was that they could sort of hide this from the IRS, that no one would know what they did. But with the blockchain, you have a record of transactions. And to the extent these are issued under the Genius Act by brokerages and banks, you'll have a record of the transactions. So it's one of those things that I think there was a lot of hype and a lot of interest, but it's not a protection from inflation. And it's not something that really makes economic sense. It's like getting dollar bills and just taking them home and putting them in a wall safe or putting them in a safety deposit box. Well, you had dollar bills already, but you could at least earn interest. And right now you're getting a pretty nice return on your cash. The stable coin guarantees that you're not going to get a return. Now, there's another new crypto twist that's even worse than the stable coin, which is people that are investing in these companies that are using investor money and borrowed money to buy other cryptocurrencies.
Wait, explain that. Say that again.
I know. It doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense. So I'll start over. I'll give you an example, because when I saw this, I thought this is like the tulip craze in Holland, where people went crazy buying things with no value. So about a week ago, there's an electric bike company called Volcan, based in Austin, Texas. They raised $500 million. The $500 million is going to be used to buy cryptocurrencies. People bid up the shares from $9 to more than $44 on the day of the announcement. So this company is taking your money and buying cryptocurrencies, but you're paying more than face value. You're literally paying a premium to put your money in this company, and they're telling you, I'm going to go buy cryptocurrencies. So it's similar to somebody saying, look, I'm creating a fund, and I'm going to go buy U.S. dollars. And people bid the fund up to, you know, $1 billion, and there's only $100 million to buy U.S. dollars. Now, the share price of the fund is higher, and you're literally paying $2 to get one. So you have these companies that are called crypto treasury companies, and they're buying, they're selling stock. Stock is trading at a premium to the underlying value. And it just makes no logical sense. But, you know, there's a company called MicroStrategy, which uses their own money from stock sales, borrowed money to buy Bitcoin. And because Bitcoin has gone up, the value of MicroStrategy stock has gone up. But it still trades for more than the underlying Bitcoin. So if you really love Bitcoin, just buy Bitcoin directly. This middleman is extracting a premium, and you're paying more than the underlying investment. But this is happening really very commonly right now. You know, one that you wouldn't even believe is called the Hype. There's a coin, a digital token called the Hype. And an investment company called Diamond has raised $300 million to invest in Hype. And the principal is a guy named Diamond. He said, you know, we think that this that Hype is pretty special. And I'm thinking, this is almost a joke. I mean, it's like a Monty Python joke. You're buying a coin called Hype, and you're selling stock so that people will buy this new digital coin. As soon as somebody doesn't want it, it has no value. You know, it's very similar to the people when... Go ahead.
No, So I always think back to Bitcoin, and I did not think it would still be around, but it is. It's up, what, 300% or so, I think you just said, or some crazy number like that. How is that? Why? What's driving this?
Bitcoin was originally created as a hedge against inflation. And the design behind Bitcoin was there are only going to be so many Bitcoins that can ever be issued. So therefore, it will have value. And Bitcoin had its own architecture. The design was you had to solve a very difficult mathematical problem to earn a Bitcoin. And it's a peculiar thing because it burns a lot of electricity. You have a giant data center. You have data mines to mine Bitcoin. And because it's scarce, people think, okay, there can only be so many Bitcoins, so the value will always go up. The problem is, if people lost faith in Bitcoin or they just decided to invest in something else, there's nothing behind Bitcoin. You can't pay your taxes with Bitcoin. You can't. It's not readily exchangeable if people don't want it. And it has become, I think, a very dangerous thing. People call it an asset class, but it's not really an asset. There's nothing behind it. You know, if you're afraid of inflation, you can buy gold, you can buy exchange-traded gold funds. That's a real commodity. You can buy real estate in REITs. That's something behind it. There's something real there. Bitcoin could go to zero, and there's really nothing to stop it. And these other coins, the Hype coin, the Doge coin, which was created as a joke and now trades, Ether, you know, there's nothing behind those coins. But because investors are so hooked on literally the Hype, they're buying it and they're paying a premium. And it's worse because they're actually paying more for the stock in companies that own these coins than the underlying coins are worth. So it really makes even less sense than buying Bitcoin directly. But if you're absolutely intent on buying Bitcoin, you know, open your own wallet, buy Bitcoin, and control the keys yourself, then at least you're paying dollar for dollar. You know, buying into these companies, you know, just doesn't make any sense at all. But there are a lot of investors that want to do it, and it seems like whenever you announce one, there's more interest, people pay a premium. But it makes literally no sense for you to pay, yeah, you know, $2 or $3 for company stock that owns something that's worth $1.
Well, I am still confused by it all, for sure. Got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. When we come back, Louisiana DMV scam returns. We'll talk about that. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. It seems like these DMV scams will not go away, Guy.
No, it's back, and it really has hit almost every cell phone user in Louisiana over this past weekend. What happens is you get an email, I mean, rather you get a text message, and when you look at it, it looks exactly like Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles. They've copied the look, Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles, expresslane.org. And what it says is, final notice, enforcement penalties begin July 27th. Your traffic violation remains unpaid under Louisiana code. It goes on to a code number. If it's not settled, the following will be enforced. suspension of vehicle registration, license suspension, debt move to collections plus a 35% fee and possible legal proceedings and negative credit impacts. Pay immediately here. Now, there are a bunch of problems with this. First, if you are late paying a fine, the DMV does not suspend your driver's license, your auto registration. Most importantly, DMV does not send text messages. This is a complete scam. It's something DMV has put out. If you look at Louisiana Wallet, they have a warning because they put that out because they realize this is hitting everybody. The other thing is when you look at it, it's made to look very official, Louisiana Office of Motor Vehicles, but it's area code 266 rather. Now, people in Louisiana know, all right, we're South Louisiana, we're 504, Baton Rouge is 225. What is 266? That has nothing to do with the state of Louisiana. We only have five area codes in Louisiana. That's not one of them. So it's not coming from Louisiana. It's a perennial scam. If you click the link, it'll take you to a website that looks, once again, very much like DMV, and it'll have an opportunity for you to pay. And the intriguing thing is, and I ran this through a separate computer that wasn't online, the amount is pretty trivial. It's like $3.37. So you think, well, it's not the worst scam in the world. But what will happen is if you click and if you pay any amount, that'll be a test amount. Now they'll know what your numbers are, what your credit card number and security numbers are. And they'll start hitting you with more charges. And usually what these people do is do a series of little ones, hoping that you won't notice. And then in the next statement cycle, start hitting you with bigger and bigger charges until you reach the point where nothing is getting through. But this is a big scam. It's hit everybody in Louisiana that they can find. And DMV's aware of it. They're trying to alert people. And certainly we want to do the same thing. DMV is not sending you final enforcement penalties by text message.
So I guess any government group that sends you a text message, don't open it because that's not their normal way of communicating with you at all, right?
That would be the
safest course of action. Delete it immediately. Get it out of your phone.
Yeah, block the sender, report it as a scam. And the IRS, when IRS sends letters, U.S. Postal Service, DMV sends letters. And if you have L.A. Wallet, you can communicate. And I strongly recommend everybody get that. It's a great way to have your driver's license on your cell phone. And, you know, people can forget their wallet or their purse when they get in the car. Almost nobody forgets their cell phone. So now you've got your driver's license if you're ever stopped and needed. But yeah, this is a scam that takes advantage of people's credibility. And it does look good. I mean, they've copied the website very carefully, but DMV does not use text messages.
So that's the best advice moving forward for sure. Real quick, Guy, well, actually, we've run out of time. I'll save that for next Monday because it's an issue not going away. As always, we truly appreciate your time, your insight, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's great to be with you.
Thank you, sir. Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll be right back, folks. We'll check in with Ian Hoke, who's in for Scoot today, to see what he has coming your way. Welcome back, folks. Just a reminder, we believe in the power of being everywhere. Listen to WWL anytime, anywhere. Get the WWL shows you love. Dave Cohen, Tommy Tucker, Newell, Scoot, Ian, Sports Talk, and the local content you crave on the Odyssey, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn apps. We're joined by Ian Hoke, who's up next in for Scoot. What do we have coming up?
Hey, good afternoon, Newell. We're going to start out talking about Crescent Park and the Riverfront for All project. You know, Crescent Park cost us $32 million to put together. A decade on, it's covered in litter. There are no permanent restrooms. It has severely limited access to the public. We'll speak to Michael Karam, who's the director of Parks and Parkways, and also be joined by Jeff Schwartz, the city's director of economic development. The Riverfront for All project really is going to be a really special thing that everybody should be excited about. But I'm going to see if I can make sure that we understand who's going to pay for it once it's open in terms of groundskeeping and security, things like that. Also, this is the 100-year anniversary of the Scopes monkey trial, where John Scopes was put on trial for teaching evolution in Tennessee. We'll talk about that with Dr. John D. Fitzmaurice III from UNO's Department of History and Philosophy. We'll also talk about why there is 2 minutes and 53 seconds of missing footage from the surveillance tapes that we're told by the DOJ and FBI is the raw, unedited footage of Jeffrey Epstein's cell block on the night that he died. We'll get some answers about that missing footage.
All righty. Well, Ian Hoke's in for Scoot, and he's headed your way. 3 hours packed with a lot of great stuff, folks, so stay tuned. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Again, make sure if you're out and about, stay hydrated. I think the heat index, Ian, do you recall what the heat index is?
I didn't see the index.
Is it 115 or something like
that?
It's a crazy number.
I'm trying not to look at it right now. I'm just waiting for the rain to get here. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So be careful out there, folks. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Ian Hoke's in for Scoot. He's up next. Have a great Monday evening, and we'll see you guys again in the morning. Take care.